It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Why is the internet such a toxic place for women?
I was out with friends in San Francisco, and my phone just started vibrating on the table constantly.
This is Zoe Quinn. She's a game designer.
I just saw a flood of notifications come in. People were talking about what a whore I was, and people were talking about putting dead animals in my mailbox, and it just kept speeding up. Like how you count times between thunderclaps to sort of tell where the storm is. All I could do is sort of stare numbly at my phone. Someone's like, your ex just posted like all this crazy stuff on this forum and it got deleted almost immediately, but I thought you should know. And I'm like, oh God, what? This was an abusive ex-boyfriend that I had just finally cut out of my life. He knew exactly how to engineer it. They were finding out the home addresses of my friends, compiling a dossier and saying, you know, let's burn her to the ground, Wikipedia editing my time of death to my next scheduled public appearance.
Oh God, what?
It basically went straight to the rape and death threats and continued unabated for weeks and months and now years.
Nobody should have to experience anything like that. And yet, increasingly, women do. Zoe Quinn's case is famous. It's what came to be known as Gamergate. But this kind of cyberbullying, doxing, rape and death threats, cyberstalking, this is on the rise. Women are not the only victims, but they are disproportionately targeted. One study found nearly half of the women surveyed had experienced online harassment. And for women under 30, that number is even worse. 76%. So why is the internet such a hateful place for women, and what will it take to fix it? And in the meantime, how do women like Zoe deal with it? Because it's been 3 years and she still gets death threats.
It's weird that it doesn't really faze me at this point anymore, unless it's like some sort of new information that makes it clear that, you know, they're nearby and able. It's just kind of the background noise of my life now.
First of all, can I just say, I'm so sorry.
It's okay. I mean, I still think the internet is a net positive, and it's given me just about everything good I've had in my life, too. So if that's the cost, then that's the cost. But I would rather it not be for everybody else.
Did you ever consider quitting, finding a new career?
That was one thing a judge told me. When I eventually did get a restraining order against my ex, where he, like, looked at the stack of documents in front of him, said, I don't really understand what the internet is about, but if it's like this, you should just not be on it. And I'm like, Your Honor, there's no offline version of what I do. I'm an independent game developer. You're essentially asking me to give up my career. And he said, you're a smart kid. You'll find a new career. And that was it.
Well.
But it, less than a consideration, though, that I couldn't work that much. Like, I would try, I would sit down and try to code or something, but it's not like it ever really stopped or slowed down. And every time that I did something that's part of my job, like going to a conference or showing a game, there would always be death threats associated with it, people talking about if they should bring a knife or a gun to one of my talks and stuff like that. So it makes it really hard to focus long enough to do anything, because like as recent as late last year, people were going through my grandfather's obituary looking for names of family members that they hadn't already gotten to. And that's just, it's hard to do anything in that environment.
Yeah, I can imagine this experience might have really poisoned your feelings about your profession and about game design. So let's back up and talk about what you love about games and game design. What keeps you going in the work itself?
I've loved games pretty much from the first time I interacted with one. They were there for me when I was growing up and had kind of a rough childhood. It was like these whole other worlds that I could just lose myself in. And that was just like sincerely magic to me. Games as a whole really kind of captured my imagination just because of this interactive element where you're sort of dancing with this third party that you'll never meet probably. And you have to sort of account for their feelings and create this experience and sort of anticipate what they'll do and then put cool things in the way of what they'll do and give them choice and give them agency. Like, this co-authorship with thousands of strangers is just really moving to me. It's like the ultimate show, don't tell. You know, it's a step beyond that. It's do, don't tell.
The games you design are, you know, a far cry from what I suppose a lot of people think about when you say just video games. You know, you don't do first-person shooters. These are not massive role-playing fantasy worlds. The games you design are much more intimate, personal.
Yeah.
For example, we should talk about your game Depression Quest, which I played recently, but let's walk through it a little bit.
Depression Quest is a short, I say semi-fictional game because it's like extrapolated from my experience and a lot of other people's experiences. And it was sort of an effort to show people that depression isn't just like a bad mood and depressed people aren't like stupid. It's just that you can't do something. You can see what you wish you could do, but you can't.
I have, and still do to some extent, struggle with depression. And so I was kind of worried as the game starts going that this was going to start triggering something for me. It was sobering. It was very familiar. I will say the game didn't make me feel horribly depressed, but it wasn't necessarily fun either.
Yeah, I have a strong belief that not all games have to be fun. Fun is just another emotion that we can evoke in players, but it doesn't have to be the only emotion, you know?
It was also, you maybe designed the game so that people who haven't experienced depression know what it's like. And in that sense, yeah, I kind of felt like, oh, I have to make sure my husband plays this game because there are things that I think he's always been my rock. But there are times when I feel like, I just kind of wish you knew what this is like.
Yeah.
The other thing that was really interesting was seeing there are times when you're playing the game and, you know, there's a moment where you have to choose. I don't know, your girlfriend says, hey, we're going out to a party. Will you come? And you have to choose. You'll go to the party and stand in the corner. You'll go to the party and immediately drink a whole lot. Or you won't go to the party. None of those, of course, are good, healthy choices. Mm-hmm. And then you see the good, healthy choices and those are just not available to you. Why did you set it up that way?
The number one thing I hear from people who don't understand depression at all is like, oh, just, you know, think positively, you know, just shake it off. You can do it. Just do it anyway. Just do it anyway. It's like saying, oh, you have a broken leg. Just walk it off. Just walk it off. You got this. So it was partially in response to that. And partially, like, you know, other people with depression would maybe feel like for a few minutes they're not alone, that maybe somebody else sees them and understands that. You know, make it easier for people to talk.
Well, I also felt like the choices you did give kind of set up this concept of baby steps. So you can kind of play through, well, I could go home and just hide under the covers, or I could call someone. I kind of think maybe if somebody who tended to have depression played that, it might, next time they're feeling bad, prompt them to think, okay, what's a slightly less bad choice I could make right now? So it was interesting. What have people said to you about it?
Oh, God, the response was overwhelmingly positive because I made this game after I had just lost a job because I got pneumonia, and I was working this really crappy minimum wage coffee job. And I just was sort of like, I need to pour myself into something so I don't kill myself. And I thought maybe four people would play it, three people would be like, what is this? And one person would be like, oh, yeah, kind of, okay, but like it spread like wildfire and all of these people talking about going to therapy for the first time or being like, yeah, it's the first time I've been able to talk to my dad about it. There's a number of therapists who use it with patients and their families. It's been I can't actually wrap my head around it. And anything I could say about it would seem like a floppy platitude in light of how I actually feel about it.
Do you think the game content had anything at all to do with the vehemence, you know, with which you got targeted? I mean, it's a game that makes the player recognize feelings that they might prefer to avoid. And I wondered if the game itself made a certain cohort in the online gaming world feel threatened. You know, guys who are depressed, don't have much of a life, they're working dead-end jobs, their closest relationships are with people in chat rooms.
Absolutely. And I mean, the frustrating thing is, like, that actually has a lot of things in common with me, but when you combine this sort of alternative way of making games with the fact that I don't look like what most people would think of when they think game developer, and what the sort of undercurrent of bitter, defensive nerds that yell at anybody that doesn't look like them, being part of gaming and saying they can't be a real gamer and stuff like that. When you combine all of this, and my ex very carefully crafted the post to sort of put a bow on me like that, I was just like standing in the perfect intersection of all of this pent-up anger and frustration and rage and hate that had been already, you know, percolating in the games industry for a long time.
Yeah. Who are these people who've attacked and harassed you and so many other women?
There's a couple different kinds of people, right? There's the people that actually know you, like a bitter ex or a professional rival or something, or you're getting targeted by just some rando nightmare person. So there's like the individual one-off people that have very personal grudges. And then there's the people that don't know you at all, that see you as a symbol of something they dislike, or they're part of a community that is founded on organizing these sorts of campaigns against people. And there's many online that usually targeted on marginalized groups. And they will share targets and information about those targets. They will basically combine their efforts to dig up whatever they can on them and their family and their friends. Then you have the people who just kind of get swept up in that and don't verify or dig deeper. They just repeat it. So you've got the useful idiots in that corner. And then you have the lieutenants. You have these people that make a name off of pointing the mob where to go next. These people have like YouTube channels, crowdfunding things set up, and they monetize taking advantage of pre-existing fan bases of hating people and harassing people and stalking people. And they play to that.
So that's the side of it. And we've been talking about this as a social problem, but can't you also see this as a technological problem? I mean, aren't there things Twitter or Facebook or Google or chat room hosts could be doing to protect people online?
I think a big part of it is designing around consent and streamlining reporting flows and making it easier for people to actually report things. Because it's like, say some rando online is like, yeah, I'm going to make this meme that has her boobies in it. I have to like go through and flag each individual thing and then try to hope that the back end of this platform has any sort of capability to create a case that's centered on the target and not the perpetrator, because they might see like little one-off things and they don't actually get the whole picture that this is all against one person. It's all the same thing. It's a mess to deal with, technologically speaking. People need to have the willingness to actually move on this and to draw the line. Tech is sort of looking to the law to tell them what to do. And the law is extremely painfully far behind. So tech really has to be our first line of defense. And they're just looking at an outdated system to make them actually do their job. And I wish it wasn't that way.
Zoe, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Zoe Quinn is the developer of Depression Quest, which you can find a link to on our website. She has a memoir about her experience during Gamergate coming out this fall. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International. When women complain about online harassment and abuse, you know what they're often told? Just go offline. Don't use Twitter. Stay away from your email. Well, that's not only unfair. If you're a professional woman, it's not even really possible, at least not without damaging your career. There's a serious financial cost to being a victim of online harassment. So where's the law when you need it? Danielle Citrin is a legal expert on hate crimes in cyberspace and how the law can, and sadly more often can't, help. Steve Paulson asked her to explain.
The first thing, I think, is to go to law enforcement, right? If it's indeed the combination of threats privacy invasions, so like the posting of nude photographs without your consent, your next to your home address and the suggestion you're interested in sex, defamation, sort of this perfect storm of both terrifying and then reputation damaging. My first advice would be to go to law enforcement. Now,
You talking about the local police department?
I am. When individuals go to federal law enforcers, FBI, the response is it's not a matter of national security. And it's understandable. They have limited resources. And increasingly states, and I'm just going to talk about California for a second, but whose attorney generals are working incredibly hard to train law enforcement or peace officers in California about what it is that is wrongful about harassment and stalking and threats and how it can be punished.
But I'm wondering if police departments are really equipped to deal with this, you know, such a technology-based crime. And because, you know, the people who are doing this are usually are pretty tech savvy.
So that's not to say that we don't have a long way to go in terms of educating law enforcement, not only about the law itself, you know, explaining to law enforcement officers that there are these laws on the books that you can enforce, but also the technology. You know, local law enforcement, they're great at street crimes. It's what they do well. And it's true that when you come to them and you say, there's this threat, it's terrifying, and then show series of screenshots, they often don't know the place to start for an investigation. Like, they don't realize that they can get a warrant to go to the online service provider and then get an IP address and then go to an internet service provider. More often than not, people leave crumbs behind that if we have the resources to expend, we can track and, you know, find perpetrators.
And what are the penalties then? I mean, let's say you do track down the offender, and I'm sure it depends on, you know, what kind of abuse we're talking about. What are the penalties?
So, you know, stalking and harassment laws at the state and also at the federal level will often consider the crime a felony. So it's usually this perfect storm of threats of violence, of defamatory comments that hurt reputations, as well as privacy invasions. And sometimes it's your social security number that's spread throughout the internet.
So you're saying that, you know, someone who does all of this or some of this could land in jail. Can you also sue the person for damages?
There are civil remedies. You could sue for public disclosure of private fact, for defamation, for intentional infliction of emotional distress, but it is expensive. And so, you know, most victims, when I talk to them, they said, look, I can't even afford to pay my rent.
Right.
I can't. I've lost my job. I can't find a new one because of my decimated online reputation. Like, how am I going to afford a computer forensic specialist to track down my perpetrator and then hire a lawyer? And that is makes sense. You know, it's a difficult road to hoe. It's expensive. But if you can get a lawyer to represent you pro bono and, you know, with the publishing of my book and high profile attacks on both women in gaming and then, you know, the spread of nude photos of Jennifer Lawrence and others, I think we're gaining some traction and attention to the issue.
What about civil rights law? Does that come into play here?
I feel like that's the heart of my argument of my book, is that we ought to understand cyber harassment as ultimately a civil rights violation because it deprives people of crucial life opportunities. You know, we think of what is a civil rights violation is when somebody's targeted because of their membership in a group. And the ways in which they're targeted is to deprive them of a job, right? Of the ability to speak and engage. And so often the abuse is seemingly, we're not sure why someone is targeted, but because they're targeted in such sexually threatening and such sexually demeaning ways, we have some sense of the motive. And it fundamentally deprives people of the ability to work. You know, so 90% of employers use Google as a research tool when they think about interviewing people. And even employers for their own current employees will use Google as a search to check up on employees. And over 70% of the time, employers say that there is a negative result. So in looking for candidates to interview, over 70% of the time when they use Google, there is a negative result. And the sort of top reasons for why there is a negative result, meaning the person doesn't get the interview, doesn't get the job, is nude photos. The second is, like, you know, what seems like threats and lies about the person, like really damaged reputation.
But the problem with a lot of this is, I mean, let's say that you found yourself in this situation. You haven't gotten job interviews, but how are you going to know that you didn't get the interview because your prospective employer has, you know, has Googled you or, you know, did, you know, name the instance like that? I mean, that seems really hard to figure out.
You know, we can't go to the employer we don't know was ever looking at us, right, and say, you didn't give me a job, right? It's a black box.
Right.
I think there is a really important point, even if civil rights laws as they currently exist can't help us here, but I think in the way that, as an educative matter, to understand cyberstalking as a civil rights problem, because it ultimately more often affects women, and it more often affects women in ways that are sort of sexually threatening and demeaning and reinforce gendered stereotypes that make it really hard to work and to speak and engage on equal terms. And it's important, I think, to think of it in that way and to understand it's not just an individual problem, but a social problem. We all lose as a society when victims retreat and go offline and don't participate in public discourse. Like, we all end up losing when we lose their voices.
What about big social media sites like Facebook and Twitter? I mean, do they have legal and social responsibility to try to curb this abuse?
So two questions there. One is more depressing than the other. You know, the first is legal. Do they have legal responsibility? And the answer is no. So I've been working on this issue since 2007. And I feel like in the early years, as I talked to companies about this problem, it seemed too difficult, at least to many, and especially like Twitter, which was conceived itself as like a free speech platform. But over time, in my discussions with these companies, they've come to understand and appreciate that what stalking, harassment, and threats do is silence people. It pushes their own users off their platforms. And the people engaging in this abuse is contributing very little to their sites. And so what we've seen in the last 2 years is, you know, Twitter, Facebook, even Reddit banning non-consensual pornography, so the posting of people's nude photos without their consent.
And, so you just can complain and they will get pulled off.
And they'll take it down. And even Google and Bing will de-index nude images if you let them know that it's non-consensual pornography in searches of your name. So it doesn't take down the content from the main site, but it will de-index in a search of a victim's name, which is often very much what they want, right, is to not have employers and clients and friends see. And Twitter, this was about a year or 2 years ago, made clear that they think that cyberstalking, harassment, and threats is really costly and that it deprives people of the ability to be digital citizens. This is, I'm sort of paraphrasing the general counsel. And I think increasingly we're seeing sort of a set of agreements that online abuse is incredibly destructive, and it's destructive of their own communities. And it's not, you know, economically a good thing for them either. You know, we saw advertisers pull out of Facebook when there were these pro-rape pages. And you had a change.org campaign run by Soraya Shamali and Jacqueline Friedman, who were, you know, gathering all sorts of petitions for Facebook to realize that this is not a good thing, these pro-rape pages. Like, rape is not a joke. And advertisers, including Toyota, started pulling out their ads. And so I think what Facebook realized, and then they made this big announcement, we're going to take down these pages, and we know it's not humor, and it's destructive, is they realized it's not good for business.
Right. Now, we're talking about really a pretty recent phenomenon here, I mean, which is really the result of new technology, which keeps changing. And I'm wondering if there are any historical analogies here. I mean, you know, domestic abuse, sexual harassment, big issues a few decades ago. Can we learn anything from how lawyers responded to those problems?
Absolutely. You know, I felt like in researching and thinking about the book that the very same arguments that women heard in the 60s about domestic violence and about sexual harassment in the workplace, that, oh, come on, boys will be boys. If you don't like it, leave, right? If we think about domestic abuse, those same ways we once trivialized domestic violence and sexual harassment in the workplace were the very same arguments that victims of cyber harassment were faced with. The response was like, eh, get over yourself. Boys will be boys, right? Don't take it so seriously. Oh, come on, you don't need to use Twitter, right? So we, you know, we saw a recurrence of this trivialization of really serious harms. And so I take a sort of took a play out of the playbook from social movement of the past, right? The domestic, the folks and lawyers and activists who helped change hearts and minds about the meaning of domestic violence. It used to be like a private problem that families should solve and that police had no business in it. We didn't even call it domestic violence. And in the late 60s, activists gave it a name, right? They called it domestic violence. And the same is true for harassment in the workplace. Kitty McKinnon and others named it as a phenomenon. This is sexual harassment of women in the workplace, right? We needed to name it and understand it and to help people see it as a social problem. And so we've been here before.
And yet my impression, I could be totally wrong, but we hear about individual cases of horrible abuse, right? But I don't really sense a movement here.
The Cyber Civil Rights Initiative and Without My Consent are anti-cyber harassment advocacy groups that it's amazing the kind of change that they've helped produce. So let's just think about law as a Geiger counter. Are we getting people's attention? In 2013, there were two states that criminalized non-consensual pornography. And with the dogged help of the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative and Professor Marianne Franks at Miami Law School, we now have 34 states and a proposed federal statute to criminalize an invasion of sexual privacy involving the posting of nude photos. So it's sort of, I think, an amazing thing going from two states to 34 states and a proposed federal statute. And that only happens when you get lawmakers' attention and show it's a really serious social problem.
Danielle Citrin is a legal scholar and the author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Steve Paulson talked with her. Back when I was hosting a call-in talk show, there was a listener, a guy, who really didn't like me. That's allowed. People don't have to like me. But this guy started posting about me on Facebook. He wrote about how much he hated the show, and he hated my questions, and he hated the sound of my laugh, and it stung. But when I asked people at work what to do about it, they said, rule number one, never feed a troll. Just ignore him, and eventually he'll go away. That didn't really feel very satisfying, but I didn't know what else to do. Well, now some professional women are getting fed up with turning the other cheek. After Lauren Duca wrote an article for Teen Vogue called Donald Trump is Gaslighting America, she found herself sitting in a chair waiting to speak live with Tucker Carlson on Fox News. His producers had booked her after a single tweet of hers went viral. And for her, this turned out to be the last straw.
I was on Tucker Carlson's show. He brought me on to talk about the incident with Ivanka on the plane.
As you've doubtless seen on the news everywhere, a member of the tolerant left screamed at Ivanka Trump and her family, including her young kids, on a JetBlue flight yesterday. The man, who was a lawyer from Brooklyn, berated her about her father before being kicked off the flight for disorderly conduct.
I had tweeted, you know, Ivanka is poised to become the most powerful woman in the world. Don't let her off the hook because she looks like she smells good.
You know, I don't want anyone being yelled at on a plane. I don't want anyone yelling at me on a plane. I don't want to yell at anyone on a plane. But I think that, you know, where do those protections end, too? Kind of would ask you the same question as
well,
the funeral breast.
But wait, that's not at all what your tweet suggested. In addition to the one that we just read, you put, I think we can put it on the screen.
My tweet didn't even, didn't talk about the plane at all, actually. So what are you referring to?
Well, it was
to?
Within the, look, Ivanka Trump was in the news about because she was screamed at on the airplane, and you say, don't let her off the hook. And then you go on to say in another tweet, Ivanka has it all, and by that I mean a job, a family, and sinister complicity in aiding the most aggressively anti-woman candidate of our time. She's his daughter. What is that?
It's a very hostile segment. And he basically spent the entire time trying to position me in opposition to him.
It's sinister for a daughter to capitalize on the power of feminism and uniting women and empowering women while supporting a candidate who is the most anti-woman candidate this country has seen in decades.
What does that even mean?
Bombarding me with all these different conversational threads and cutting me off.
She looks like she smells like vanilla. I mean, who's objectifying women here?
Attempting to make it seem through this sort of like emotional subterfuge that I was unable to answer a question when he was sort of trying to frazzle me. And I stayed relatively calm and didn't accept it.
Does Trump make you feel like you're crazy? That's the impression I'm getting.
Oh, my God. Are you calling me crazy? That's adorable.
I'm asking
That's
you. You said
so
on Chelsea Handler, he's committing psychological abuse on you.
At which point he resorted to reading other articles I had written for Teen Vogue.
I also read Liam Payne is 100% certain One Direction will continue. Adriana Grande rocked the most epic thigh-high boots at Jingle Bell and
so
Black
teen,
China and Rob Kardashian went through the messiest breakup of 2016. Those are your other pieces. But I'm trying to get to what you're writing about Trump taking a break from the thigh-high boots.
I felt like I had been punched in the stomach because it was such a sexism is often so stealthy and so coded. So to kind of get that full Monty explicit version of it was genuinely knocked me off my feet.
You know what? I did write about Ariana Grande, and I did write about the abusive, bigoted,
deceptive president. Those pieces were a little smarter than your piece about threatening the sovereignty of a whole religion.
Twitter as a whole was talking about this clip, and it was sort of Christmas weekend. It was every time I opened my inbox, it was like the Duel of the Faiths was playing. I was receiving death and rape threats on Christmas Day. I mean, I could tell that they were coordinated based on messaging boards on Reddit and 4chan, discussing with one another how they should be coming at me. And then I spoke to one of my trolls. I wrote a piece for Teen Vogue called To Trolls with Love. It was sort of cathartic for me and more emotional than I usually am in my writing, because it was saying, this actually really hurts my feelings. I don't have shame in saying that tons of people being cruel to me online chips away and takes something from you. So I wrote about this, and one of my trolls wrote to me to apologize. And he said, you know, I'm one of the people that's been shit posting you, and I'm a father, and I realize that's not the kind of father I want to be or the kind of person I want to be. We talked on the phone. I sort of flatly responded, okay, but why? And he was very articulate, very calm. It was very apologetic. I mean, I was sort of shocked at how, quote, air quotes, normal he seemed. And basically what he said to me, he came from the Donald Reddit messaging board. And he said, you know, we were intimidated that you didn't back down during your segment with Tucker Carlson. You didn't back down even after you were met with this sort of militarized, coordinated harassment. Oh, it's made me more angry. As fired up of a feminist as I was before all of this, it feels like I evolved into the next Pokemon, like, of myself. It's just, so many things have been confirmed. I think often our experience of sexism is coded and stealthy, and, you know, there's so much of it being taken less seriously at the pitch meeting or sexualized by your interview subject. But all of the things I experienced with the harassment was truly the most blatant textbook level misogyny, where it just lit a fire for me in a way that, I mean, it's not a pleasant feeling. I'm not happy by it, about it, but I am activated by it. Multiple women have come up to me and said, you know, I cried watching that clip because it just felt so familiar, because I've just been told to shut up and not been allowed to speak and been spoken over and sort of laughed at, that little toxic masculinity giggle he does. It's so common. I got a word in after he cut me off that did not make it to air. You're a sexist pig. I do know that he got that in his earpiece, and I feel validated by that a little bit. I'm sorry.
That's Lauren Duca. She's a freelance journalist and contributing editor for Teen Vogue. Coming up, writers Roxane Gay and Siri Hustvedt share their tactics for surviving and thriving as women of the internet. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI. Public Radio International. Roxane Gay is a writer with a big online presence. She's widely admired as one of the best feminist writers and critics of her generation, and she's a prolific tweeter with a take-no-prisoners approach to trolls. Earlier this year, her publisher, Simon & Schuster, gave a book deal to the far-right journalist Milo Yiannopoulos. He's one of the few people permanently banned from Twitter for online abuse. Well, Roxane was so furious, she publicly rebuked Simon & Schuster by pulling her own forthcoming book away from them. Raymond Tangekar sat down with Roxane Gay recently to talk about her uncompromising approach to online critics and about her new short story collection, which is called Difficult Women.
There are certain themes that kind of come up again in a lot of your stories. One of those is sex, and often it's kind of intertwined with violence. There's another story in the book, Break All the Way Down, that involves a mother who's grieving the loss of her son and who seeks out a violent, abusive partner. Is there like an idea that you were trying to explore or communicate when you were writing about that?
No. When I'm writing my fiction, I don't have like an agenda. I don't have like a grand idea. And with that story, I was writing about grief. And what would you do to numb the pain if you lost your child in an unimaginable way? And so I thought you would want to feel a different kind of pain to cover up the emotional pain. And so she finds just a terrible guy, but it's consensual. It's consensual terrible. And so that's uncomfortable. That's an uncomfortable place to write and to be in. And I just loved just exploring what that would feel like.
And, you know, like so many great writers, I mean, I think your stories are infused with a great amount of empathy, and you really do like inhabit the mind and like understand the motivations of these characters. And I read somewhere that when you write, especially about difficult subjects, you try to write to the point of unreadability. Is that true?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
You know, I write to that place where I'm horrified and uncomfortable, and where I have to look away, and where I know the reader is going to have to look away. I just like to transgress boundaries in ways that I think are creatively productive. And so I do write to that place of just absolute discomfort.
Why do you push yourself like that? I mean, why do you do that kind of emotional labor? Is there a deeper, like, a universal truth that you're trying to get at?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it, it doesn't feel like emotional labor. It's certainly challenging to go there, but it's fun.
Really?
And I don't mean that in a sociopathic way. It's just, as a writer, you're always looking to challenge yourself and to challenge your comfort zones. And so for me, there's a lot of creative joy to be found in going to these dark places. Yeah, it's hard to put it into words, but there is a lot of creative joy, while at the same time recognizing that, you know, these are dark stories and painful themes that I'm looking at.
So, you know, the book is titled Difficult Women. How would you define difficult women?
You know, in many ways, just like with Bad Feminist, the title is a bit tongue-in-cheek, and it's challenging this idea that women are difficult when we have opinions. And I think a difficult woman can be a lot of different things, but generally a difficult woman is a woman who takes up space and who uses her voice and demands to be heard and seen.
Do you approach writing for the internet any differently than you do writing for a print audience?
No, I don't. I don't, because I don't ever want to compromise how I say something or why I say something.
Huh. But at the same time, I would imagine that when writing for the internet, you're probably more likely to hear from your audience.
Well, you are more likely to hear from your audience, but I can't allow that to shape how I write. And so I don't.
I guess what I'm amazed by is you are an incredibly prolific writer. But in addition to that, you're also like a really prolific tweeter. And I would mm-hmm. think that as someone who, you know, who writes frequently about sexuality and race and gender, I would think that you would get a lot of pushback from some groups or people. But what I find really inspiring and kind of remarkable is that you do take time and you do engage with the people who try to, you know, criticize or troll you.
Yeah, I do. And I don't do it for any noble reason. I do it because you got to bring dirt to the light. And these people are horrible. And not because they disagree with me. I'm talking about the people who harass and troll me and just generally seek to make my life more miserable. You know, I think it's important that people realize the scope and breadth of what women, and particularly women of color, deal with on the internet.
And just to put things in perspective, I mean, how much of this kind of like trolling would you face on a weekly basis?
It really depends on the week. It really does. And it depends on sort of whether I'm in the news or not. I recently made news because I pulled a book from a publisher, and that was quite horrific that week. So it just depends on what's going on.
So I guess what I find fascinating is, I mean, you're someone who's been quite open about struggling with shyness and finding your own voice. And so I would think that someone who's shy wouldn't want to engage with their trolls in such a public platform.
Oh, it's very easy to engage on the internet. That's why I'm on Twitter, because on Twitter, I have the, not courage necessarily, but I'm outgoing enough online to be able to say what I want when I want to say it. What I wish I could do is take that energy into my day-to-day life.
What is it about Twitter that provides you that freedom or that space to kind of be more open than you normally would?
I think it's just the safety of the screen. And, you know, I can be in my own space at home most of the time or on my phone. And I can, you know, like it's easier to just think quickly and to feel witty and to feel smart, like in that environment where you're not like directly facing someone. And I think that's the exact same reason why people troll online.
Do you have a personal philosophy when it comes to, you know, dealing with Twitter trolls?
Yeah, my personal philosophy is that nothing good is coming of engaging with them. That engaging with them is, again, it's just bringing their behaviors to the light and letting people know this is not okay. This is not how we talk to or treat each other. But I keep it in its proper perspective. And I also don't really encourage anyone to engage with my trolls because they're just trolling. I mean, 9 times out of 10, they don't even believe the things that they're saying. They just are bored and lonely and clearly suffering in some form or fashion.
That's remarkable. Even when talking about your trolls, you still speak of them with a sense of empathy and like this attempt to understand them and their motivations.
I mean, I have to believe that someone who would create a Twitter account just to harass me about my looks on a random Thursday is someone who is desperately sad in their own life. Like, I have to mm-hmm. believe that, or they're just pathetic. And that's sad. Like, I have at least a life. So mm-hmm. it's very easy to have empathy for people like that.
Roxane Gay wrote the essay collection Bad Feminist, and she has a collection of short stories that's just out. It's called Difficult Women. Raymond Tungekar talked with her. So we've been talking this hour about how to make sense of the kind of online harassment that is routinely directed toward women, especially women who have something to say. But, you know, when has that not been the case? For instance, Siri Hustvedt is a novelist who also writes scientific papers about the brain. She's 62 years old. She's not active on Twitter, but she has plenty of experience being demeaned in public, including on stage, as a keynote speaker, and even while getting an honorary doctorate. She told Steve Paulson that she feels a lot of empathy for young women who are trying to develop their voices on new and noisy platforms, while at the same time having to cope with old-fashioned, garden-variety misogyny and sexism.
I've been at this for a very long time, and I have come to be able to better recognize when what is happening has very little to do with me. In other words, it has to do with the fact that I'm a woman. And yes, it happens with a certain regularity. People are offended by a woman who assumes her authority.
So you're saying that among writers, women are often perceived differently than men, than male writers?
In every give me a field, you know, give me a discipline. And I would say that especially if the discipline involves what are often thought to be masculine traits. So, for example, the mind, the intellect has long been associated with masculinity, the body and emotion long with femininity. And if you are crossing that line, the chances of being punished are very strong.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that the internet offers is the chance for empathy, you know, seeing the world through another person's eyes, you know, learning to see the world from another point of view. And I guess I'm wondering, I know you've written about that in the arts, in painting, whether that might play out any differently on the internet as well.
Well, I think what's different about the internet is the possibility of so much back and forth. And if you think about this as a good thing, you know, it's a dialogical place. It's a place where, for example, if you want to contact a researcher, there's an email there often at the end of a paper, for example. This allows interested parties to have exciting dialogues that one wouldn't have had in the library when I was, say, a PhD student 30-something years ago. I was there with my books having an internal dialogue, but no one answered me back. So I think that's a beautiful quality that the internet has.
Well, and following up on this notion of the back and forth the online world offers, I mean, you know, with social media sites in particular, I mean, you've written about the idea of mixing, of how our
yes.
sense of self is actually, it's not just sort of something that we have ourselves. I mean, it's sort of created in relation to other people.
Yes, I think this is very important. It's a philosophical point. It's one I deeply accept, and that is that we are not made alone. We are not self-created human beings, right? We're all born out of the body of a woman. We all need to be taken care of as infants or we will die. And that very slow human development, it is extremely slow. As mammals, you know, we don't walk for a year. Think of it, most of us. So that engagement with other people, it is part of brain development. It is part of all physiological development. I'm not trying to argue that, you know, there's no separation. There's no difference between one person and another. But I think it's essential that we understand that nobody creates him or herself.
Mm-hmm. So you come at these questions from an interesting perspective because, you know, you're a novelist, you're a critic, you write a lot about the mind, and you sort of bring together the arts, the humanities, the sciences. And I guess I'm wondering if, as we talk about sort of these problems of abuse online, whether if we could sort of bring in a perspective from the humanities, if that can offer something that we're missing right now in these conversations.
Well, I remember when actually my daughter was harassed in junior high school, and this was early online stuff, but this person, this young girl, had signed her name. And I talked to her parents, but I also talked to her on the phone. And I said, you know, if you can remember that the other person has an inner life that is as large and complicated as your own, I don't think you will attack that other person in the way that you've done. And, you know, she listened to me. I have no idea if the message came home. But I think that is something that the humanities offer. You mentioned earlier the internet as a forum for empathy. I think that reading literature is a forum for empathy because that is a place where we can have experiences that we would not have in ordinary life. In fact, we can have experiences that we would shy away from in ordinary life. So a book that was very important to me when I was young, Crime and Punishment, is about a young student full of ideas who kills an old woman. Now, someone like that, I would run screaming from in real life.
But it's fascinating to read about that person.
Well,
yes.
Raskolnikov in the Hands of Dostoevsky is, you know, a deep human experience, but it is a safe experience because we know Raskolnikov is not going to jump out of the book. And so we can enter into dangerous human terrain safely. I call it the aesthetic frame. And that, I really believe, is a way of extending one's consciousness, of making oneself a larger human being.
Siri Husbett is a novelist and critic. Her latest book is an essay collection called A Woman Looking at Men Looking at Women. She talked with Steve Paulson. That's it for this hour, but there's more in our podcast feed. To subscribe, look us up on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. And if you enjoy the show, make sure you recommend it to a friend. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mark Rickers produced this hour with help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, and Steve Gotcher. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strangeamps. Until next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.